and entertainment. Again, that's World Environment Day Global Goals Fair on Saturday, June 3rd from noon to 4 at the Hawthorne Hostel, 3031 Southeast Hawthorne Boulevard in Portland. More information can be found at kbu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Hot tamales and cha-cha.
Tune in to Bread and Roses Friday, May 26th at 6 p.m. Devin Febreriello and Kat Meow Garcia talk about the upcoming Real Voices Summer Camp for female and non-binary youth.
We need to work toward producing and creating films and television from maybe some other vantage points.
I was slowly learning how to deconstruct these images and reconstruct them in a way that represented me and my feelings and my stories.
We'll also hear from Kai Tillman about navigating the film industry as a trans person and a new workshop he's piloting for women identified and trans people.
The idea of the workshop is to create an environment that's safe, that people can feel comfortable asking questions.
And featuring surprise guest Miso.
Hello, Podcat.
Bread and Roses, May 26th, 6 to 7 p.m. on KBOO Portland 90.7.
Good morning and welcome to Between the Covers. I'm David Naiman, your host. Today's guest is writer, editor, teacher, and publisher Jeff Vandermeer. Vandermeer is perhaps best known for his contributions to the literary genre known as the New Weird. He is the author of many novels and collections, including City of Saints and Mad Men, Finch, The Book of Lost Places, and the co-authored bestiary, The Kosher Guide to Imaginary Animals, among many others. Vandermeer's writing has won 3 World Fantasy Awards, a Nebula, a Locus Award, a British Fantasy Award, and the British Science Fiction Association Award. He's also the editor of many significant anthologies in the field, many of which are co-edited with his wife, the Hugo Award-winning editor Anne Vandermeer. His anthologies include The Best American Fantasy, The Big Book of Science Fiction, The Weird, A Compendium of Strange and Dark Stories, Sisters of the Revolution, a feminist speculative fiction anthology, and the cult classic The Thackeray T. Lambshead Pocket Guide to Eccentric and Discredited Diseases, among many others. On top of all of this, he's also the author of the landmark writing guide Wonder Book, the illustrated guide to creating imaginative fiction. You would think with all of this, his writings, and the significant anthologies and guides he has contributed to the field, that Jeff Vandermeer would be a long-standing household name. But it wasn't until 2014 with his New York Times best-selling Southern Reach trilogy, 3 books, Annihilation, Authority, and Acceptance, released in quick succession by FSG, all within 1 year, that Vandermeer leaped into the cultural consciousness at large. Yes, Annihilation won the Shirley Jackson and Nebula Awards, but it also made over 30 year-end best-of lists, was optioned by Alex Garland, the director of Ex Machina, to be made into a film starring Natalie Portman, and prompted The New Yorker to dub Vandermeer the Weird Thoreau. Jeff Weird Thoreau Vandermeer is here today on Between the Covers to talk about his latest much-anticipated novel, also from FSG, also optioned for film, entitled Born. Colson Whitehead calls Born a thorough marvel, a book that continues Vandermeer's investigation into the malevolent grace of the world. The New York Times says this coming-of-age story signals that ecofiction has come of age as well, wilder, more reckless, and more breathtaking than previously thought, a wager and a promise that what emerges from the 21st century will be as good as anything from the 20th or the 19th. The Los Angeles Times calls Born the most beautifully written and believable post-apocalyptic tale in recent memory. Kirkus, in its starred review, says Vandermeer's deep talent for world-building takes him into realms more reminiscent of Cormac McCarthy's The Road than of The Shire. And Booklist, in its starred review, says Vandermeer marries Bildungsroman, domestic drama, love story, and survival thriller into one compelling, intelligent story centered not around the gee-whiz novelty of a flying bear, but around complex, vulnerable characters struggling with what it means to be a person. Welcome to Between the Covers, Jeff Vandermeer.
Thanks for having me. And I do need to say one thing, which is that Thoreau was the weird Thoreau. So
Thoreau was
kind
the
of
weird
hard
Thoreau.
To yeah, yes. top that.
Yeah, he was pretty weird himself. Yeah. So what's interesting when I assembled these comments that mm-hmm. we just read
right.
is how many ways the book is described. So mm-hmm. apocalyptic yes. tale, coming of age story, domestic mm-hmm. drama, survival thriller, mm-hmm. eco-fiction. Mm-hmm. And the New Yorker even called it a trans-species rumination on the theme of parenting, mm-hmm. All of which seems fitting because the title character, Born, itself is a shape-shifting, hard-to-describe creature. Mm-hmm. But it made me curious, if you were having to give your elevator pitch, what is Born about? Could you tell us maybe what your initial description would be and maybe orient us to how the book opens.
Right. Well, I described it early on as Godzilla versus Mothra in the background while a Chekhov play goes on in the round in the foreground. And what I really wanted to do is I wanted to wed the epic and the personal in a way that I don't think is that common. I also wanted to make sure in the third act that, you know, because I have these kind of epic elements, a giant flying bear that terrorizes this ruined city of the future, for example, that it didn't descend into kind of like a Hollywood CGI superhero movie in the third act, you know, that I kept my eye on the personal. And the personal is Rachel's relationship with Bourne, this bit of abandoned biotech that she actually finds entangled on the flank of the giant bear while it's sleeping. And so obviously with those kinds of elements, I'm dealing with science fiction, but I'm also kind of dealing with fantasy in that I thought it'd be interesting to have this post-apocalyptic situation where there are elements that read like fantasy just because Rachel, the narrator, doesn't, you know, the scavenger in the city doesn't really, she's not a creator of this stuff. So just like we don't know how our smartphones work really or how to fix a car, it would be kind of that kind of a situation. And things just kind of escalate from there because Bourne grows. Bourne is a made creature, potentially made by this company on the edge of town that's been sucking resources out of the city. And as he grows and begins to speak, you know, he begins to change kind of the future of the city.
And you speak to something that I think is really remarkable about the book that people are picking up on, is that even though we have this lethal flying mm-hmm. bear, we have this shape-shifting mm-hmm. Piece of biotech that has consciousness, we have hordes of bioengineered children fighting bear proxies.
Oh, and bear proxies that are both venomous and breathe fire at one point.
And yet people are really talking about this mm-hmm. this emotional connection, this foregrounded... Mm-hmm. These questions of what it means to be a person, what it means to raise mm-hmm. A creature, about love, about betrayal.
Mm-hmm. Well, I really wanted to write a novel this time because The Southern Reach is really, in addition to everything else it's about, is about people who cannot connect, who are very isolated. And that was fine for that series, but here I wanted to write about people who are trying to connect. And by people, I mean that term in quotes, you know, because Bourne is not a person, but is he a person? What defines a person? Is it the shape that you take? Is it how you behave? Is it what you say? And so some of those conversations between him and Rachel, especially as he's kind of growing up as a child, are more than one thing. Sometimes it's Bourne trying to tell Rachel, I'm really not like you, you know, and Rachel not picking up on it because she's seeing this thing as a child. Hmm. And so that is the heart of the story. It's about people trying to be their better selves in very difficult situations, which is something you see in the real world all the time.
Right. Well, you mentioned this difference between orientation mm-hmm. between Bourne and the Southern Reach trilogy. Mm-hmm. And it feels like in one respect, they're dealing with similar issues, mm-hmm. mainly human relations to non-humans. Mm-hmm. In one case, whether it's animals, plants, and fungi, but in this case with biotech, with a consciousness. But they seem to be approaching things in opposite ways. Southern Reach has the Area X, a pristine area, and mm-hmm. Bourne is in a sea of contamination. And the characters in Southern Reach don't have names, mm-hmm. whereas in Bourne, naming seems to be part of the process. Like both your mm-hmm. the naming that you're giving to mm-hmm. things, but also Rachel's naming mm-hmm. seems important, the naming of Bourne. But also the personal narratives mm-hmm. seem more foregrounded in the book. But while Southern Reach is directly grappling with climate change, mm-hmm. it feels like Bourne is sort of obliquely addressing climate change. And one of the ways is the fact that Rachel is a climate change refugee. And I was hoping you could talk a little bit about that and how that informs the book.
Right. Well, I think that Annihilation, Southern Reach kind of bring you up to the edge of apocalypse in a way. And there's no way to really show what happens after the third book because it would just be so alien that it would be impossible to describe except in the most surreal terms. And also in Annihilation, those books, it's kind of like everything's peering out of the vegetation. There's a very dense landscape, very, very intentional. And in this book, I wanted the landscape's kind of in the backdrop, and it's the people and the animals that have names, that have kind of more agency. And it's interesting to me that for those first books to work, for Annihilation to work, I had to not have the names. Every time I had the names in there, I knew less about the characters. Here, I needed the names, but I didn't need names for other things. Like there's something called just the company. The city's never named. For some reason, I needed those elements to be more distant in that way. And that just shows what I'm trying to foreground. And it is a situation where Bourne is post-apocalyptic. It's kind of postulating a situation where we've run our course with fossil fuels, you know, obviously still in more fantastical than science fictional kind of directive, but kind of showing what happens after apocalypse. How do you pick up the pieces if you have a chance, if we still kind of vaguely survive the cusp of climate change and what that might be like? And even the giant bear, yes, he's very literal. Everything in my books that are monster-wise has to be literal, but also figuratively. You know, I think for people who are displaced, for people who have their whole lives ruined in a day, it is like something inexplicable appeared on the horizon.
So the figurative aspect of the bear being that an inexplicable thing.
Yeah, whether it's climate change or anything else, war, or whatever.
Yeah. Well, I was heartened to see a climate change refugee because I think about the refugee crisis in Syria and how at the very beginning people were talking about how it began as a climate change issue internally, that all these people were leaving the rural part of Syria for the cities for years before we'd noticed.
Before,
and then they collapsed the infrastructure in the cities, and then they were fleeing Syria.
Right.
But it feels like a real failure of the media now that it's not in the foreground of anyone's minds that a lot of this refugee crisis is at least partly and significantly a climate change crisis.
And one thing about Bourne, in as much as it indirectly kind of references some of this stuff, I wanted everyone in the city to be a refugee because I think that even people who are sympathetic to refugees are very othering about them. They're always somebody else in some other place that we can help. They're not us. And in fact, they are us. They're exactly like us. And so, you know, there's obviously a lot of racist stuff about refugees, but then there's also what I would call kind of a liberal sympathy or neoliberal sympathy that I find a little bit off as well. And so that's why everyone in Bourne is from somewhere else. They're all refugees because we all are going to be affected by this. And then also, you know, when I write about these kinds of things, I could never write directly about them. I think that's presumptuous. But you can still touch on these themes if you do it in the right way with the right distance.
You wrote this great article on The Atlantic about the things that influenced the writing of Annihilation, a book that you wrote in 5 weeks, which I'm sure will create a lot of pain for the writers listening to this show. You talked about the ways the Gulf oil spill and your dental surgery that you were undergoing at the time affected the writing, but also weird things that were happening in reality that felt like they were inviting themselves into the narrative. The gas fumes in your car, the fungal explosion in the trunk of your car. And even you doing a simulated break-in of your own house in order to sort of get an idea of what that would feel like for when you were writing Annihilation.
Yeah.
So I was curious if there were any analogs in the writing of Bourne. Were there things that became obsessions or that were out in the world that were contaminating in a beneficial way the writing of Bourne?
Well, I think that for one thing, the Annihilation books are very different breed and that there's a lot of paranoia in there that's not in these books just because of who the narrators are. I do remember being in my car and being in the kind of the character of control for authority and seeing a squashed mosquito on the inside of my windshield. And I wasn't sure if I was channeling control or my own paranoia at that point, being in the middle of it, thinking, who squashed a mosquito in my car? Who's been in my car? And then use that in the scene. So there was a lot of that. And I think it's very useful in general for creative writing for writers to think about the tactile nature of what they're doing and how lived-in experience is very important to that of some kind. I mean, I got in a lot of trouble doing this morning news literary tournament where I said one book could have really benefited if the guy had actually fallen down a well and known what that was like, or lived in a well for a bit because he had a scene in a well that didn't convince me at all. And I got a lot of crap. Oh, writers should just do it out of their imagination. But you find out things when you do that that you wouldn't know otherwise. For Bourne, it was more an accumulation of detail about decayed urban landscapes that when I was on book tours and things, I would go to places and I would like pick up tactile detail. But then also, you know, I grew up in the South Pacific and I've been thinking for a long time of how can I write about that even indirectly? Because again, even if you're there for 4 or 5 years, you're not a tourist, but you're not someone who's part of the landscape. See, I think you have to be very cautious about how you write about it. But here, you know, with Rachel's background coming from an island nation, I was able to access some of my memories of growing up in Fiji and put them to use. I was once lost on a reef, oddly enough, at night. My parents' flashlight went out. We got separated. And I was oriented by this giant crown of thorns, glowing starfish, finally, which is the only way I knew sea from shore. Mm. And that image keeps recurring in my fiction. You know, is kind of there just in the initial impulse of Rachel reaching out to grasp this glowing thing that reminds her of her childhood growing up on an island because it looks a little like a sea anemone. So some of those moments are in there. There's a lot of sea imagery that I didn't even realize was in Bourne until it was pointed out in the New York Times review. And then I realized, oh, that makes a lot of sense because Rachel is coloring the whole landscape with her past, right? And how she describes it, you know. But that hadn't even occurred to me. So there's some subconscious stuff going on there as well.
Huh. In case you just tuned in, we're talking to author Jeff Vandermeer about his latest book, Bourne. Well, in the Southern Reach trilogy, you were inspired by Northern Florida wildlife refuge. Mm-hmm. And I read that with Bourne, you were inspired partly by a Tallahassee wastewater treatment plant. So can you talk a little bit about the role that plays as place or as inspiration?
Obviously it's a facility that's doing a job that's very useful, but at the same time, it's very strange because it's a prime birding place. The birds go to the holding ponds there and there's a lot of nutrients and whatnot that they can pick up on. And so sometimes there was even a snowy owl there once that people came from miles around to see because it was such an unusual bird to have there. And I also, there's one scene, very little tiny scene that is so delicate, I think, in Bourne, where Rachel sees a mallard or a duck with a broken wing. It's just kind of not really a throwaway thing, but I think it's symbolic of something. And I did, in fact, see that out at the wastewater treatment plant, and it was so poignant because mallards mate for life. So the one mallard had a broken wing. It probably wasn't going to survive, but its mate was just sticking with it. It wasn't going to fly off, and that really stuck with me. Mm. But it's also kind of apocalyptic because for some reason at the wastewater treatment plant, there are these gouts of flame rising above the domes and things. And it just got me to thinking about life that's in places you don't expect. And that's one thing I really wanted to explore, because in addition to pristine wilderness, we really need to think about the biosphere in urban spaces and how we can preserve it for our own well-being as well.
And is the pond of discarded biotech that emerges out of this pond, is that coming from the wastewater treatment plant also?
Well, that's actually an interesting thing because part of it probably is, but just like it's also something that shows up in Annihilation. When I was growing up in Gainesville, when we came back from Fiji when I was around 9 or 10, I lived in Gainesville, Florida, and we rented a house with an abandoned swimming pool in the back that was full of fish and frogs, and you know, herons came to it, and I kind of tended it like an amateur biologist, and it showed up in Annihilation in the biologist's background as something in her past, and now it's shown up as Wick's biotech pool, you know, Rachel's partner who takes discarded biotech and kind of reforms it into his own creations. So things like that, you know, they're images that are from their autobiographical that have some power to me, and that I then try to kind of like pick through and say, what does this actually mean? So sometimes you'll see these things recur in novels because I'm still trying to pick through what it means to me.
Yeah. Well, one of the themes in Bourne, as we've mentioned before, is what is a person? What mm-hmm. bestows personhood on someone mm-hmm. or something, but also goes into the nature of consciousness and whether we as humans are willing mm-hmm. to concede consciousness mm-hmm. to non-human others, right, whether biotech or otherwise. Mm-hmm. In the case of Bourne, we're talking of biotech that has a consciousness, but this question of whether we'll see that in others seems to go through a lot of your work. Mm-hmm. You said before that this is an area that seems to be a big blind spot in fiction when looking at, say, animals, mm-hmm. that writers do a ton of research to make a world believable, mm-hmm. To make the science in the story solid, mm-hmm. but that when it comes to animal behavior, for instance, they rely on science that's 30 years old mm-hmm. and outdated and yeah. even proven wrong. Mm-hmm. That it's a, like you were saying about looking at life in urban spaces, it's an perhaps a issue of what we're willing to see and look right. at and pay yeah. attention to. And I was wondering if you could talk a bit about some of the science that particularly fascinates you about animal, plant, or mm-hmm. fungi mm-hmm. Behavior mm-hmm. that breaks down this sense of like a human-centric consciousness mm-hmm. world.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the thing is that we swim in a sea of propaganda about animals. You know, part of it comes from folk tales that were useful at a particular time, but kind of typify things. Like, for example, our owls are probably the dumbest birds out there, and yet, of course, we have this thing of them as being wise owls, right? So already you can see in very, maybe not harmful ways, but how things are actually portrayed as not accurate. We have this thing where if animals are cute, we're more likely to want to save them. We perpetuate mythology about sharks, for example, some of which are very social animals, are much more intelligent than we give them credit for. But we do, I think, have to get beyond this idea of trying to find human-like intelligence in other animals, because their intelligence is very different. It is almost like encountering an alien intelligent species. You know, a dolphin lives in the water. A dolphin communicates in ways that we can't even inhabit in any possible way. Just the fact that it lives in water and its skin is sensitive to water in a way that ours isn't and communicates in a different way is something that is informing media theory now about nature and different ways to communicate. So the idea that we with our paltry five senses can somehow be the experts on what constitutes intelligence is a little disturbing. Octopuses are incredibly intelligent. And I also kind of bridle at the idea that we have to assign importance to an animal based on whether we think it's intelligent or not. Personally, I don't like killing any animal if I can avoid it, and I think that we should just value life in general. But it also speaks to how we treat habitats, right? Because animals are the ambassadors of these habitats, and they're the things we most think of when we think of like wilderness. And so when we devalue them, it allows us to devalue habitats more, even though we are also dependent on those same habitats. So it's our fate and animals are linked. And the more that we try to de-link ourselves from that, the more trouble we get into. And it's just that simple. These things are linked.
Hmm. Well, when you mention getting away from looking for a human-type mm-hmm. intelligence, you did have this really interesting conversation with Charlotte Wyatt, the fiction editor at Gulf Coast, mm-hmm. where she brought up anthropomorphism.
Yes.
And you echo something that in one of my conversations with Ursula K. Le Guin, she talked about this as well, that a scientist's reluctance to anthropomorphize mm-hmm. instead of leading to accurate description and objectivity mm-hmm. has led us to presume that they have no intention and they have no right. emotion behind their actions. And I was hoping you could maybe unpack that a little, because Le Guin talks about the need for more subjectivity in mm-hmm. science, essentially, mm-hmm. that we should allow our relational aspect mm-hmm. with animals mm-hmm. to inform, or even our own emotions mm-hmm. around mm-hmm. being in relationship with animals to inform our interaction with them. So could you talk a little bit about your thoughts on that?
Well, I mean, there's all kinds of things to unpack here, because science has at various times also been very sexist and racist. You also have situations where human beings have been displayed in zoos. And so you have to be very careful about the anthropomorphizing issue, because it's also fraught with all these other issues. But, you know, just looking at, for example, Great Apes, I was talking to Karen Joy Fowler, whose last novel dealt with great apes and research on them, and was very actually factually accurate about that. For the longest time, even with apes, the fact that they weren't willing to ascribe intentionality to certain actions that were actually very close to human actions meant that they went along with these testings and these terrible conditions for creatures that were not that far removed from us, and allowed them to rationalize basically bad behavior. So just from, you know, the point of view of how you treat animals, it's very important. But then it's an act of empathy and imagination to at least try to get beyond the human gaze, to kind of get a sense of just how wondrous and amazing the world we live in is with these other life forms. Even certain kinds of ants and bees, things we think of as very, very low on the chain of sentience, seem to have, according to latest animal behavior research, more free will and more intentionality, not a human level, but than we imagined, and that their brains are more complex. Like bird brains, we just discovered, have twice as many neurons or synapses, something like that, than we thought. So even though they're smaller, they actually have more capacity. What this leads me to believe is that we don't know enough biology yet. Even to just have discovered that is crazy. So when we're taking action about the environment, about animals, we're doing it even in the current situation on very limited information and doing a lot of self-harm as a result, in addition to the intrinsic ethical question of being good stewards of the world around us. So
I think it might have been the New York Times article. I'm not entirely sure, but they point out that a lot of times when we have encounters with alien creatures in science fiction, traditionally they have a humanoid shape, that there's ways in which we see ourselves in these alien creatures, and that with Bourne, you're really making that impossible intentionally. That Bourne, the creature, not only usually appears in very non-human shapes, but is always changing shape. So, and has many senses that we could never recognize as ones that we are able to perceive through.
I think that in my fiction, it's been very important to have that physicality and to not have these animals throughout my entire career be stand-ins for human situations. And one reason is I want to push back against, there has been a tradition in science fiction, sometimes useful, sometimes not, where the aliens are always stand-ins for something on Earth. Right? And that can be very problematic. You've led to a lot of situations that are basically like frontier settler, Native American situations, for example, in space, in very problematic ways, not examining what that means. So I try to be very, very specific and precise, and to try to imagine non-human life in hopefully unique ways. And it's also kind of, I was really, really felt vindicated by the New York Times review for this reason. I've always felt like because of this issue, I've been kind of like passing through different genres and being claimed by different genres, but that I've been doing something a little different. And so it was very vindicating to see them focus on that and acknowledge what I've been trying to do.
The issue that has come up the most, it seems, in a lot of your interviews around this book is whether this book is hopeful or not, which it seems like a tricky question, given that by scientific consensus, our situation is dire,
right.
That we aren't acting fast enough to avert catastrophic climate shifts, that even if we did the Paris Accords, which we're not able to do, we're at the sort of the mild end of catastrophe. We're not out of catastrophe. And so it seems like on one hand, writing a book that was hopeful would be problematic in that light, but to provide none would also seem to be equally problematic.
Right.
So tell us a little bit about, it seems like a strange question, but
No, it's not a strange question at all.
You don't think it's a strange
question? No, I don't. And it's actually really relevant in a lot of different ways. First of all, I do think the book is realistic in this sense, in that it's postulating a situation in which civilization has basically collapsed. And it's hopeful in the sense that there are still people around, because, you know, there are forecasts that say that extreme weather will be to the point by like 2050 or 2070 where we will not be able to sustain any agriculture. And so, for example, when you have novels where there are still millions and millions of people living in the United States in, say, 2070, and they all seem to be eating okay, and there's no explanation for any mitigation of that forecast, that's very unrealistic, and that kind of hope is well, frankly, BS. But on the other hand, there's this weird question with regard to the literary and hope and post-apocalyptic fiction where it becomes commodified. Hope becomes the code word for, this is much more entertaining than The Road. You know what I'm saying? Read my book. And so I bring this up a lot when I'm asked about hope, because even though I do think this is a hopeful book, I am also very wary of commodifying things that should not be. It's one thing if we're talking about the merits of puppies. But if you're talking about climate change, if you're talking about things that are affecting people right now, I think it's very problematic not to just say, look, I want to talk to you about my book. You know, I have to. I think it may be useful in some context, but at the same time, I'm not going to try to sell you. I'm not trying to sell you something in that way, in that commercial sense. So in that context, you know, I don't like books that are monotone. Even like Authority has a lot of, I think, dark humor in it. And so, you know, people are surprised that there's a lightness in here. There's a lightness because of the human relationships. But the fact of the matter is you don't just stop living when you're in extreme situations. And there are moments of light, even when there is a lot of darkness. And so I wanted to capture that as well. I mean, this is about characters who are trying to connect. And I think Rachel's really heroic because she succeeds in that, even as everything is falling down around her. And if there is something to preserve about humanity, it is that, you know.
Well, it was a real pleasure having you on Between the Covers today, Jeff.
Yeah, well, thank you. And thank you for such great questions.
We've been talking today to Jeff Vandermeer, the author of Born. You've been listening to Between the Covers. I'm David Naiman, your host.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Vanport Mosaic Festival, May 26th through the 29th, at various locations throughout North and Northeast Portland. The second annual Vanport Mosaic Festival will offer an exploration of the history and legacy of Vanport through a series of films and plays, lectures and conversations, and guided tours. Audiences will be invited to reflect upon the journeys of those who lived and died in the city of Vanport. As part of the festival, there will be screenings of a selection of Vanport oral histories. Again, that's the Vanport Mosaic Festival, May 26th through the 29th, at various locations throughout North and Northeast Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Welcome to the film show on KBOO. Today we have a special program for you about Portland history in film. I'm S.W. Conser, and I'll be joined in just a few minutes by my co-host Jen Chavez. Jen is bringing us a special